Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Tuesday, September 27th, 2016. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And we're a little tired because, of course, we were up last night late watching the first presidential debate between Hillary Rodham Clinton and Donald Rodham Trump. And my take from it was that Trump embarrassed himself. Noah's take, which is sort of interesting, was less about his performance and more about not only his content, but Hillary's content. Noah, tell us a little about Hillary, because you were not so impressed by her.
No, I wasn't. I thought she was robotic, rehearsed. She had a lot of pre-prepared zingers that you could see the gears turning in her head as she was trying to reach for zinger A7 and apply it as naturally as she could, and it was unimpressive, frankly. I thought they landed flat. And then finally, she was really focused on demographic maintenance. She was talking explicitly to Democratic groups, Democratic voters who have been frustratingly not speedy to join her campaign, to support her campaign. So she was talking about trying to put the genie back in the bottle with regard to characterizing Donald Trump as not your father's Republican, saying that this is trumped up trickle down economics.
Another terrible line.
Awful line.
It was a terrible line.
And an attempt to a bare naked attempt to get Democrats to jump on board. Sort of a real, you know, hearkening back to Bush era Democratic policies. So Donald Trump's performance was awful in spite of the fact that Hillary Clinton wasn't good, because of it.
Abe? Well, you know what's so interesting about that is that it turns out that she was the one that only had to clear the low bar to win. We had thought in advance that all he had to do was not be crazy. In fact, all she had to do was just sort of speak facts and clear a sentence.
Okay, I'm going to disagree with both of you. First of all, I think everybody thought that he did pretty well in the first 15 minutes. He was controlled and contained, and he was focused on a very potent message, which is that you've had the reins of power. People like you have had the reins of power for 30 years, Hillary. You've done nothing. The country has gone down the tank, gone down the sewer since people like you have had the reins, and now you need a deal maker like me to fix what you broke and to get us back on track. And it was reasonably focused and a good message, and she was on the defensive at the beginning. And then he went off the rails, and as he went off the rails, she got on the rails, and she cornered him time and again into making blunders and mistakes that are going to dog him from now until November. She effectively got him to say proudly that he did not pay federal income taxes. She got him to say that it was good business to be rooting for a housing meltdown that lost 5 million people their homes. The kind of thing that Republicans dreaded Obama could do in 2012 to Mitt Romney, and never quite did, although his ad campaign did, Hillary Clinton did to Trump last night. Now, were her one-liners bad? Yes. Was her bar low? I don't think that her bar was that low, because he was trying to goad her, interrupt her, throw her off her pace. He interrupted her 57 times or something like that. And instead, she goaded him. And by the last 20 minutes, he was just a shambling mess of a wreck. I mean, it was astonishing to watch him.
Yeah, but see, that's what I think. I mean, an hour and a half is a long time to talk without recourse to facts. Eventually, you're going to start sort of gluing words together that have no business being in the same sentence, and that's what he did. I think he's more hurt by that, just by having had to have spoken that long without really knowing much, than by the nasty stuff that she pulled out of him. I mean, because we already know the nasty stuff.
No, you know the nasty stuff. You know the nasty stuff. You watch this granularly. You know that there has been this issue about releasing his tax returns and what might be on the tax returns and whether his father gave him a $1 million loan or gave him $14 million. This is stuff that you know. 100 million people were watching last night. Now, the fact is people know who Trump is. They know who Hillary is. We've got two incredibly famous people running for president about whom people already have pretty solid opinions. But a lot of the details that she went at last night will come as news to a lot of people who were watching.
If policy matters, I think you're absolutely right. I'm not entirely sure.
I don't think that's
sure.
policy. Nothing that I said there has to do with policy. His not paying taxes is not policy. That's not policy. That's a character quality. His not paying taxes, his rooting for a housing meltdown is not policy. And then when she went at him at the very end on his views on women, and she mentioned the beauty pageant contest winner Alicia Machado, he went nuts and started sort of yelling over her, rattled. And then this morning he basically just cost himself another 2 days, you know, created a new 2-day news story about how she got fat and that was really bad, and thus affirming the point essentially that she was making at the end of the
I'm suggesting, and that meltdown didn't occur at the very end necessarily. He started saying nonsensical things within the first half hour. At somewhere today, Hillary Clinton got up with the steely resolve to go meet ISIS on the battlefield, as she's been doing her entire adult life, right, allegedly, yeah, according to Donald Trump. But he said that in the
first
half hour.
You've been fighting ISIS your entire life.
But he just said something that popped into his head, and I will agree with you, John, that I think he did good in that first 15 minutes insofar as people were listening to what he was saying and not watching him. If you watched him, you saw body language that I thought was dominating. I thought he was very domineering. He interrupted her frequently. He leaned into her. He was doing the sniffly thing. He was not being a debater who respected his opponent. And I think that for voters who are undecided at this point, that sort of stuff matters.
You know, I actually disagree. I think what appeal Trump has, the whole point of Trump is to win, is to conquer, is to control. He can do it ugly. He can do it revoltingly. And that's still his his appeal.
If that resonated to you, wouldn't you already be a Trump voter?
No, because here's the thing. If what it looked like at the beginning, I think, was that it was all on his turf. He was talking, she was answering him, he was pushing her, she was fighting back. He kept saying, what did you ever do? How have you helped? Your husband passed NAFTA. NAFTA was a disaster. You said you were for trade for the TPP deal, and now you say you're not. And she said, well, that's not accurate, which is a lie. And then he said, you called it the gold standard, which was the truth. So she was not, she was not like on her heels, rocked on her heels, but it was he controlled the turf, which is what he wants to do. And even though almost the entire debate was about him, which is ordinarily, I think, good in this context because it means the election's about him and not about her. Nonetheless, when the tide began to turn, it was, okay, let's hear another answer that's going to embarrass you. When you're asked about cybersecurity and you start blathering about your 10-year-old being good with computers, let's start talking, you know, and defending Putin. Again, defending Putin, who has I believe you're the one who pointed out to me, has a 6% approval rating in the United States. And Trump took 2 minutes last night to say, I don't know if it was Putin, if it was China. It could have been China. It could have been a 400-pound guy on his bed,
yeah,
who hacked the Democratic National Committee, which is nonsense since the FBI says it is reasonably sure that the Russians hacked the DNC.
And the Senate and House Intelligence Committee ranking members, both of which have put out a statement to that effect. I think that TPP thing really perfectly illustrates my point insofar as he had the facts with him. Hillary Clinton was on her heels. She did call it the gold standard in her book. She did back off from it only because her constituency on the left said that she should. He had her there. And yet he did it in a very plotting, ham-fisted, domineering fashion in which I feel like his style is what translated more than what he was saying. He wasn't letting the facts speak for himself.
But
he was speaking with his body.
The facts can't speak for themselves in Trump's case because if you know what he's talking about, and I think we knew most of what it was he was talking about, you still had trouble assembling this kind of throwing out of terms that you've never heard, that a lot of people have never heard before, into a kind of timeline. Like he started saying, NAFTA's bad, TPP, you didn't like this, you like that, I, you know, Ford is going here, China, and this, and blah, and you're like, wait a minute, what the hell is he talking about? If you're like an ordinary person, you don't even remember what NAFTA is. Now, granted, so he's now, and I think he made it clear in his first answer, he's now very focused on the idea that maybe he can win Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And he said Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And so he knows that a lot of, you know, basically his vote, the sort of white male vote in those states, probably remembers what NAFTA is and knows what TPP is. But again, 100 million people watching, if you did a poll right now and said to America, can you tell me what TPP is? You know, they would start singing "Get Down with OPP." I mean, I don't know what they would say. It's not a term that, you know, maybe 5% of the American people, as an aggregate, know what trade promotion, know what the TPP deal, what TPP means, and then what the deal is, and then what the controversy is. So I don't think he helps himself. She's very didactic because she slows down and she starts explaining, and you start your eyes start rolling in your head because she's so boring. But at least she tries to sort of put things in some kind of a coherent narrative. And as she did, I think quite masterfully when she went after him on his taxes. She said there are three reasons why he might not be releasing his taxes, as everyone does. One is that he's not as rich as he says he is. And the second is that he's not as charitable as he thinks he is. And the third is that he doesn't pay federal taxes. And those are the only three reasons he wouldn't release them. And then he tried to trump her by saying he would release his taxes when she releases the 33,000 destroyed emails, which fell flat because it was a non sequitur. And then when he had the moment, the chance to take her down on the emails, when Lester Holt asked about cybersecurity and she said, we have Putin and this and that. And, you know, the obvious place for Trump to go was to say, cybersecurity, you're one to talk about cybersecurity. You put this nation's security at risk by taking your emails and bring them into your house. And you say you're sorry now that that's what you didn't know in 2009 that was a problem? Of course you knew. And you did it because you were trying to protect yourself because you wanted to do phony baloney deals with the Clinton Foundation and stuff. Like it was a lob. It was a pitch right down the middle. And he didn't go there because he got barren in his head, and because it was an hour in and he was tired and he didn't prepare, and he's lazy and vain and arrogant and thought he could just wing it the way he wings everything.
And so shouldn't we pause for a moment here to recall that we've sat around this table many times saying how Trump's fans had been saying, wait till the debates. That's when he's going to bring it to her. Yeah, no, he's going to destroy her. And she's never faced someone who's going to take her head on like that before. And whatever else you think about last night, he didn't accomplish that. He couldn't
not
do
only,
it.
Not only that, but you could think of any other person, any one of the top five in the Republican field besides him, could have laid her out on the floor on the cybersecurity question. Rubio, Cruz, Bush, Kasich, I don't care who it was. It was sitting there. Look, yesterday in a kind of, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but yesterday in a kind of performance art thing on Twitter, Jim Garrity and I ended up in this weird thing where I was playing Trump.
Yes,
I was playing Trump and he was playing Hillary. And the whole thing was that every time Hillary said, the reason that the blah, 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 I, as Trump, would then say, you just got to kill the bastards. Just kill them. And then she'd say, blah, blah, blah. And then I'd say, I want to kill him. You want to let him in. You want to let more. You let him in the first place, and you want to let more of him in, Hillary, just like that. And I bring this up only to say that I was just sitting at my keyboard on Twitter and I turned in a better debate performance as Trump than Trump turned in. And it's not like I had sat around for 3 months preparing for the debate.
I want to investigate why Abe said that so many of these Trump supporters said that they believed he would take it to Hillary Clinton in a way that no other Republican can. They weren't talking about policy, and they weren't even talking about affect, like you had mentioned, that he would just really stick with the tough guy routine when it comes to militarism. What they thought he would do was really dig into her in a way that talk radio hosts dig into her. They thought he was going to bring Rush Limbaugh's act to the debate stage, and finally, these cowed Republicans with their nonsensical ideals of comedy and relationships in the Senate would show how you really defenestrate a Clinton, and that's by going after them personally and with Bill Clinton's behaviors and shaming her for standing by her man in the 1990s, et cetera, so forth. In the spin room afterwards, he actually said, which I don't believe, that he was going to attack Hillary Clinton for having a husband who cheated on her, whatever that, I don't quite understand the thought process there as to how that would redound to his benefit, but he said he would have done that, but only, he deferred only because Chelsea Clinton was in the audience and didn't want to hurt her feelings.
No, but on the debate stage, he had that bizarre little, he said, look, you've been hundreds of millions of dollars spent on me. It's very nasty. You're being very mean and very nasty. By the way, most of these commercials that are very mean and very nasty are entirely focused on quotes from him, running footage of him saying things. I mean, I've seen them all over the place. And very nasty. And, you know, I was thinking about doing, so I was going to be as nasty, you know, but then I didn't. So there was some kind of implied threat, or he was praising himself for his self-restraint. But of course, since you didn't know what the hell he was talking about, again, that was part of the last 15-minute meltdown. And, you know, people said the thing about those Republican debates is the last debate that he had when he walked away, there were, I think, 10 or 9 of them left. Right? So even there, he spoke for a maximum of 11 or 12 minutes. He did pretty well for 11 or 12 minutes. And what we've now learned is that he doesn't have the stamina for 90.
And the thing about last night is, you know, a lot of debates, people get bored and they watch for 20 minutes, half an hour, and they tune out. But last night was such a spectacle, and you were waiting for things to explode. People stayed watching. And so they got the full meltdown. You know, in a way that they
we
wouldn't.
Think. I mean, again, right, you know, by the way, none of this, just we're doing this simply in terms of performance. And so the early snap polls and things suggested that she won pretty, you know, convincingly. That doesn't mean the polls are going to move. It doesn't mean that it's going to change anything. That we don't know. I don't think we're in any position saying that, you know, she really helped herself or he really hurt himself. We don't know. And that's, we should all be modest enough to know that this ability to prognosticate where this election is going is very difficult. I think that what killed him last night and what was so harmful to him was that things will linger. The tax thing will linger. He said basically that he was proud that he didn't pay federal taxes. He said that it was good business to be rooting for a housing meltdown. She didn't say it, he said it. And in that sense, that's material for more commercials. It's stuff that's going to be brought up in the second debate to see if he can answer what he was saying in the first. It keeps the tax returns issue, which is very boring when you think about it. Just, I know, liberals love to say, where is tax returns? But nobody knows what that means. But if she gets across, if there now is a serious effort to get across to undecided voters and the Democratic base.
That's where it's going to matter.
And the Democratic base by saying he's hiding that you're paying, you know, you are standing there paying 20% of your income in taxes, and he's not, and you are.
Her argument is that it's the 2012 argument. It's unpatriotic to not pay your fair share.
Right, and then finally, when Romney's real tax returns came out, it turned out he was paying a marginal tax rate of, I don't know, was 23% or something like that, and he gave away $14 million a year to charity. So what are we going to find out? We already know that the Trump Foundation is basically a scam, and that I'm sure he doesn't give money to charity, and that likely he pays very little in federal income taxes. And again, yeah, rich people, everybody does what they can to reduce your federal income tax burden. But not if you're going to walk around saying I'm worth billions and billions of dollars. You can't say one and then say it's okay for me not to be contributing to up the upkeep of the national defense, you know?
The scandal there, if there is a scandal, is that according to a Washington Post reporter, I forget his first name,
David Fahrenthold's
reporting, is that he's been funneling some of his income from events into the foundation, notably a five-figure sum from Comedy Central for being roasted by them,
A seven-figure sum from a shady ticket broker guy,
right,
who seems to have given the foundation $1.9 million for no evident reason
Can't account for why, whether or not they paid taxes on that. And that would be a crime. So that would be the scandal.
Well, it's only a crime, according to what I read. It's only a crime if he did it knowingly and did not know what the law was. And Fahrenthold caught out this kind of clown Trumpkin lawyer Boris Epstein, who is a ridiculous person and is one of Trump's surrogates, who pretended to be a tax lawyer to Fahrenthold and said, well, he'd done this and he'd done that and he'd done the other thing. And then Fahrenthold said, well, what about the Comedy Central money? And he's like, okay, well, he didn't do that and he did pay taxes. But he didn't then prove that Trump paid taxes. And anyway, apparently, if Trump said something like, I paid taxes on all of this, which he could say because his tax returns are, you know, confidential. Like, all of our tax returns, that's why he cannot release them. You cannot require anyone to send out your tax returns. If he said he paid taxes and he didn't, the IRS then has a criminal case against him. In other words, it can say, well, he knew he should have paid taxes and he didn't. So they could then just look up and see if he'd paid taxes on this money. And if he didn't, they have a criminal case against him. So he's like walking now a very, very tricky path.
But this is why I think it's, and I'll put myself out here, and I think it is acceptable to predict that Hillary Clinton will get a modest bump in the polls. It's been a wild election season, but not entirely. You can predict that when Donald Trump, which won the nomination and defeated all his opponents, he would get a bump in the polls. He did. When he finally won the nomination at the convention, he would get a bump in the polls, and he did. If this stuff resonates with Democrats, Hillary Clinton will get a bump in the polls because Democrats will rally to her side. We have surveys that suggest the public isn't really all that interested in his tax returns, even though Democrats really are. So if this resonates and it resonates with the left, and she unifies her party base behind her, why wouldn't she get a bump in the polls?
I think that's the most important element of this, which we should watch, is, and this is where there's an interesting 2012 parallel. Okay, so Romney lost, but he did have this incredibly convincing win in the first debate. And we all sitting at this table, and Republicans, you know, conservatives, Republicans across the country know that it was incredibly heartening to them when Romney won that debate. No one really, they liked it, they didn't like him, they thought well of him, they didn't think well of him, they had problems with him. But then suddenly he looked like a leader, he looked like somebody who could take Obama, you know, go toe-to-toe with Obama and best him. And there was a great sense of relief in conservative circles and Republican circles. And if Romney had never had that debate, yeah, Obama won by 4 points and he rallied on enthusiastic voters. But that famous thing about how Romney had all these missing voters might actually have been true. Romney ended up with 1 million more voters than McCain had in 2008. And that debate was very important. If Democrats feel reassured by Hillary's performance and they are made more comfortable with her for taking it to him and for saying, by the way, this by reciting this litany of leftist economic pap at the top of the, you know, about what she, all the goodies she's going to give them, including profit sharing. That was my favorite. There must be profit sharing, which apparently is a Bernie Sanders theme. That's going to mean a lot for her because, as we said in the last podcast, she's still winning. I mean, even after all the pulse surging of Trump, though it's not really surging, but, you know, her fading and everything like that, she's still up in the poll aggregate by 2 points. So she came into the debate winning, and if she wins the debate and Democrats are happier with her, some of that vote that seems to have faded away and gone in some of these polls, weirdly enough, to Gary Johnson, will revert to her. And in that sense, it's very important because it wasn't enough for Romney. He needed 2 more debates to get more people to come to his side. But this can be, and he didn't get them or something.
And also, in Romney's case, you knew Obama was going to bone up and do his best next time round. For Hillary now, there's really no indication that Trump's gonna come armed with facts and, you know, citing chapter and verse next.
Is that what he's gonna do? Is he gonna come armed with facts, or is he gonna, you know, come armed with a chip on his shoulder?
Well, it's not just that. It's also the next debate is a town hall, and though if you remember the town hall between Romney and Obama got extremely contentious and weirdly physical, where they were sort of circling each other like buzzards, or I don't know.
Don't they always do that? There's always some sort of a dynamic.
Sometimes they
there.
Sit, sometimes they don't, but it was very weird. Physically, he's got to watch it, because if he looks like, I don't care what you say, women, men, everything's changed, all of that. If he looks like he's moving in on her physically, that's not going to redound well to her benefit. But it's also, it's not that easy in a setting like that, either to filibuster or to get nasty, to get really nasty, because there's an audience there, and there's an intimate audience, and the room will chill. It's one thing for him to speak to a crowd of thousands. If there are 150 people in the room who've all been pre-selected and all of that, and he starts in on her and interrupting her and everything like that, the chill in the room will be felt through the TV.
He's done a lot of town halls, though. He's pretty good in that format.
How many town halls has he done?
During the primaries, a ton.
Yeah. No, not
there
a
he
ton.
Did it like a couple on CNN, yeah, one on like, MSNBC, yeah, he did a couple like three on
or four.
Fox.
Yeah, he did 3 or 4. And remember, he did them with Sean Hannity. So
seated, not moving around.
No, but seated with Sean Hannity and with a pre-selected friendly audience. I mean, so that's part of the. Some people were saying, you know, the problem with Trump is that he just spent 3 months never getting a tough question. And he got some tough questions last night. And, you know, I don't care. There was a lot of people, including friends of mine, whining last night that Lester Holt was too hard on him. That's insane. So what did Lester Holt ask him? He asked him about birtherism, and he asked him about...
the Iraq War. Those were the 2 fact checks.
Yeah. And what's wrong with that? I mean, by the way, you know, if we don't stop talking about this... Who said what at the beginning of the Iraq War? My head is going to explode. I mean, the great sadness last night is that, you know, he mentioned Howard Stern and nobody shouted out Baba Booey in the audience. I mean, that's really what should have happened.
You know, just also another point around the Iraq War. Another point at which any other Republican primary candidate could have taken a very successful shot at her was when Trump actually started saying, look, the Obama administration created... a vacuum in the Middle East. By the way, they left Iraq. It was bad to go in, but the way we came out was irresponsible and created
power.
Right. And then she said, "Look, George W. Bush negotiated the Status of Forces Agreement. There's nothing that President Obama could have done. We had to get out when we had to get out." Minimal reading, you know. He could have said, "Well, according to Leon Panetta." Obama wanted to get out of there much more than the Iraqis themselves did. There was room to negotiate, but he doesn't read. He doesn't.
Or we
know.
Have thousands of troops in Iraq today without a status of forces.
Yeah,
agreement.
Right.
How
right.
did that happen?
You know, anything, but you know, she could shut him down on
yeah,
these things.
Right. No, he could have said, "Yeah, we got out, and now we're back in, and we're back in much much more unsafe circumstances, and our troops are more risk than they were in 2011, and that's all because of your failure." That's what I mean. That we're sitting here. I know it's like. You know, it's like l'esprit d'escalier times a million to sit as an armchair person and say he could have said this and he could have said that and he could have said the other thing. However, these are obvious things that he could have said, and instead he goes off on these. It's understandable. It's hard. If you overprepare, that's bad. But, you know, if you go off on these, like, blatherskite tangents, you know, you harm your own case. And what's more, you know, Trump... As Noah has said repeatedly, despite some little bits of polling data to suggest that this is a done deal, Trump also has to solidify the Republican base just like Hillary needs to solidify the Democratic base. There's a poll in which he's at 90% of the Republicans, but there are three or four other polls that have him still in the 80s. And remember, there are way fewer Republicans than there are Democrats. There are way fewer self-described Republicans than there are Democrats. If Hillary has 87% of Democrats and he has 87% of Republicans, she has more voters on her side than he does. Democrats outnumber Republicans by 4 or 5% at least. So he needs the kind of, I don't like the way you're talking about this, and I don't like your trashing our, you know, the Bush family, or I don't like the way you approach this. One interesting detail from yesterday is that Trump released a list of Bush administration veterans that are supporting him. Interestingly enough, eliding the first Bush administration, HW, with the second. It's 12 years, therefore, of service that could have been involved. There were 51 people on that list, two or three cabinet officials, Ashcroft and Rumsfeld in particular. I know hundreds of people who worked. I wrote two books, one about the Bush administration, one about the Bush administration, two. I know hundreds of people who worked for the Bush administration. Thousands of political appointees in both administrations. He has a list of 51 Republicans who are supporting him that worked for Bush. That is astounding. Hillary Clinton has every single person who ever worked in a Democratic administration on her side. She couldn't issue such a list. The only question you would have is who would be the 51 people out of the 10,000 or so on that who weren't on the list. And he could only garner 51. That's a mark of a base weakness in his own party. That's like people like us, maybe people like people who have ideological views like ours and, you know, worked in the national security apparatus, are people who like worked for the thousand points of light and sort of like the more moderate elements of the Republican Party now. And he doesn't have them, and he needs them.
And that's the 30,000-foot perspective. You get down to the ground level in places like Ohio, where if it's a 5-point race, he's going to win. But if it's a 3-point race, he needs a party there to turn out his voters. And that party just hates him. They despise him.
You mean
him.
A 5-point race in which he's solidly
at 5 points. But if it's a 3-point race or less, he needs a turnout operation. And the John Kasich's Ohio Republican Party does not support Donald Trump. They made it very explicitly clear. They were attacking him on the eve of the convention. John Kasich will not be endorsing him. The Ohio Party chairman was attacking him for saying that John Kasich was an embarrassment to the state.
Yeah, look, Pennsylvania is a very good example also. So there's this shock polling that shows them, you know, very close to tied in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is a state where there are 500,000 votes that you assign to the Democratic Party from the beginning. From, you know, the area around Philadelphia. 500,000 votes. It starts there. He is strong in the rural areas, and the polling may be capturing a lot of those people. They have to be dragged to the polls. Like, that's where you need a turnout operation. They have to be reminded. And, you know, this is the other thing about his demographic that is important to point out, which is, so they're more than likely to be vote people who don't vote all the time. Right? I mean, they're sort of unlikely voters, which is why they're hard to model. It's hard to poll about them. It's hard to figure out how many there are going to be. But the one thing you know about somebody who is not a likely voter is they don't know where the polling place is because they don't go to it. They don't know, you know, they don't know what time the polls open and close. They may not even know when election day is.
They might not be registered.
Well, let's even assume that they are registered. And we're talking about now. These are people who are now showing up in likely voter screens, but which always favor Republicans. So that as they do likely voter numbers, the numbers tighten. But those likely voter screens must now involve people who would not ordinarily be in a likely voter screen, which is usually, have you voted before? Whom did you vote for? How many times have you voted before? If we have unlikely voters voting, and if we even have this kind of like depressed voter voting, if you don't have people to say, hey, come on out, you know, it's 9 to 9 or 6 to 9, it's at the First Presbyterian Church, you know, here's how you fill out a ballot. That's what these machines do, and they don't exist. Trump doesn't have them. Where these races are close, he is not, you know, unless there is a wave and he really is at the head of a movement that is going to produce things and her vote is very depressed. State like Colorado, where he's now sort of charging, again, who's going to make sure that his voters turn out?
Well, he seems to think if he yells out NAFTA and TPP, that's what'll deliver them.
Well, it may. Yeah. Under conventional, if you did that, plus someone saying, as the Obama campaign did with its unenthusiastic voters in 2012, hey, I know, you know, maybe you don't want to vote, but, you know, we're going to have a party. Come on, we have a bus. We have a bus waiting outside the apartment building. We're going to take you there, you know, and afterwards we're going to take you to the party. It's going to be great, you know. They did this like across the country at enormous.
Right, you almost have to develop a culture of a following.
Yeah, yeah, it's yeah. A, you know, it costs. There was an idea that you couldn't do it at the presidential level because it was just too costly to do this kind of national get out the vote from a. Or it's not national; they were doing it in 12 states, but you know, from a presidential perch. But when you can raise $1 billion, as you know, and Hillary's going to get to $1 billion, and Obama got to $1 billion. Yeah, you can, it turns out. And he's raised $200 million less than she so far and isn't spending it properly and is outsourcing the get out the vote drive to the RNC and other places that don't do it on the federal level and have a different methodology for doing it and really gin up more in the off years than during the presidential years. Anyway, look, all this could be wrong. This is all speculative, but... Simple fact of the matter is, if she gets her vote up, if she gets her solidifies her base and gets people more enthusiastic about her, it's game over. She's already in the lead.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the down ballots. I'm not entirely sure whether or not because the Trump campaign has sort of outsourced their GOTV efforts to the party committees. The
GOTV is get out the vote.
Right. Yeah. So the national committees, the senatorial and House committees on the Republican side, and also the down ballot candidates on the senatorial slate, like Toomey and...
in Pennsylvania, Senator Toomey running
right,
for re-election.
Portman in Ohio.
Rob Portman also running
for
re-election.
So they could... augment his tallies a little bit. I'm just curious as to whether or not these future debates are going to have an effect. I'm pretty sure, as I said earlier, that they're going to have an effect on the Democratic base. They're going to enliven the Democratic base because they're going to show Hillary Clinton is playing to win. But what we saw last night was where Donald Trump got really flustered and in his head and aggressive and word salad-y. Was when they were attacking the myth that he's made for himself, the myth that he opposed the Iraq War, the myth about the birtherism, the idea that he's just sort of gave up on birtherism in 2011, trying to convince the public the last 5 years were a fiction of their, you know, a figment of their own imaginations. That's where he got really frustrated and aggressive and angry and looked bad. But does that really do anything to the Republican base, the base of his support? I don't think so. I mean, he could make an absolute ass of himself, and I don't think it would really matter for his support.
I think it matters to the extent that if he's as I said before, the whole point of him is to conquer and to dominate. And if he's not doing that, whatever the details, I think it weakens support.
Look, what did he say at the end? He said, "I have a great temperament." She doesn't. I have a great temperament. I have a winning temperament. So, again, just speculate with me. So, if he does not well in the next two debates...
What is the next topic?
I don't remember. But there's... So, there's a...
There's a foreign policy in 2012.
Yeah. So, there's the vice presidential debate on October the 4th, which will be Somonex, which will be a, you know, 90-minute ad for Somonex. It's, you know... You know, Babbitt versus the Sandinista. I don't know. I mean, it's to be the most boring thing you've ever seen. You know, the Spanish-speaking Sandinista altar boy versus the evangelical Babbitt, you know, neo-populist. And then there are two more debates. And let's say that he doesn't do well in either of those debates. And her lead holds. Who's going to start getting depressed about voting at the end of October? Who's going to start thinking, And if he doesn't feel like a winner, if he doesn't feel like a winner, remember, we went into the last weekend, people thought Romney could still win, not just could still win, the national poll was tied. We were sitting around this office, it was certainly 50-50 that it could be Romney or Obama. You know, the state polls weren't so good, but, you know, the last two polls had Romney ahead. You know, Gallup and Washington Post ABC had Romney ahead. What if no polls say that Trump is winning in the last week? And what if the electoral polls say that he's down, you know, he's down 300, 305 to... What happens then to his mien?
And here is where his core message that the system is rigged can work against him. If he's saying it's rigged, it's rigged, it's rigged, and they say, well, then we're sunk. We're done for already. It's not, there's no, look, we can do this. We've got to, you know, bear down, get together. It's a tough fight. We can do it. Yeah. It's rigged. Look, the polls are rigged. The debates are rigged. It's all rigged. Forget it. Let's close up shop. Right. It's a very defeatist theme.
And if more people watch these debates than have ever watched debates before, the argument that he's slipping because of, you know, marionette moves behind the scenes is going to start seeming a little crazy, because everyone's going to know that judgments are being made based on mass events. So that's why you're already seeing him pull this stuff out of his hat about how somebody screwed with the mic so that we could hear him sniffling, and, you know, and Lester Holt, first he said Lester Holt did a good job, and now I gather this morning he's starting to move as he talks to more and more Fox hosts on the phone, sitting in his bed, getting angrier and angrier about how there are fat beauty queens and his mic was rigged. You know, by the end of the day, he's going to start talking about the Gold Star parents again and all of that.
Well, he quite clearly didn't read the RNC's emails, because I woke up to an email from the RNC noting how many questions Lester Holt didn't ask Hillary Clinton and why that was very suspicious.
Yeah.
So he's not getting the memos, I don't think.
I would have been on the same page. See, I was watching and I only thought it was weird. I thought that Holt was kind of helping him in an odd way. This is where because the debate was all about him. Like, why wasn't he turning to Hillary and saying, Mrs. Clinton, ISIS, your administration did X, Y, and Z, and ISIS came about. What's your answer? And then she would have to answer the question. At least then she would... He talked, I think, for 15 more minutes than she did last night.
It was pretty close. It was.
Was it?
Yeah, they were both in the 40s.
Oh, were they? I'm sorry. Well, there was something else. It was something about how, you know, the subject of conversation was 70% him and 30% her. And while that hurt him, it didn't have to hurt him. If he had done better, it would have helped him. He's the reason it went badly. He could just as easily have thrown her even tough questions that she was prepared for. And then the turf could have been on her turf. So oddly enough, it's not fair. Lester Holt asked me too many questions. As opposed to, well, why isn't Lester Holt badgering, you know, why is Lester Holt focusing the debate on Trump? Hillary Clinton's in the lead. She's the one who should have to answer the preponderance of the questions.
And also, John, just to as a little evidence to support your case earlier that she did a decent job or a good job, when he was off the rails, she got nowhere near him. She let him bury himself. She didn't jump in and dispute right. anything. She let those that stream of consciousness just spool out. Yeah,
stared deadpan at the camera.
Yeah, and look, again, we don't know. We don't know what the story is. What we do know is she's very disciplined. That's the one thing that we know, and that the main thing that could have killed her, which is coughing, she didn't do. And then there was some kind of weird jujitsu effect where he was sniffling the entire time. And then this morning he said. He said to Fox, I don't know why I'm obsessing over this quote because it just cracked me up. He was like, there was no sniffles. There was no sniffles. I mean, he speaks English like
verb
his cleaning
there
lady.
Is a problem.
There was no sniffles, Mr. Trump. I mean, who said there was no sniffles?
It's a bit of
that
a...
That was like the Shira Scheinlin line. What was it he said? A very... not very nice to police judge.
Oh, yeah.
What was it? A very anti-police... something.
That makes too sense.
Something
grammatically incorrect.
Yeah, it was like, oh, really? That's a very not
that's what he does.
And
this is a weird tick of his, is that he drops words, I think, in order to sound like he's jargony. Like, he's up on the actual, like, inside the business lingo. So when he says... When he talks about cyber warfare, he just says cyber. When he talks about nuclear weapons, he just says nuclear.
Oh, that was a good part, by the way. And this is where, I'm sorry, so we haven't even talked about policy, but this is where you get into the, it is outrageous that a person like this is even thinking of being president of the United States. So he not only does he, without knowing what he's doing, forswear the first use of nuclear weapons, which is...
While criticizing Barack Obama for entertaining that very policy.
But he forswore the first use of nuclear weapons, which is the foundation of U.S. nuclear policy and has been since 1940, since the Soviets developed the atomic bomb. Not by the way that anybody really thinks that the United States would strike first, but this was a debate in the 80s. It was a debate in the 90s. There was a whole debate about why not forswear first use, no first use, because we're never going to do it anyway, and we can make ourselves look good to the, like, Irving Kristol was for changing this policy, and had a big debate with my father once about whether or not there should be no first use or not. So Trump has no idea what this is. It's nuclear policy. And not only does he say, so he forswears first use, and then says that maybe we should bomb North Korea.
Or that China should invade North Korea.
Which, by the way, would be first use, because we would be bombing them. So in the same sentence, which means he's a policy idiot. Well, I don't know, maybe we should be more polite because he's the Republican nominee, but he is a policy idiot.
But he also said, I mean, in the same breath, while I was sort of acclimating myself to the fact that he just said no first use, he also said, but you can't take anything off the table.
She wants to take everything off. That was the other thing. Right. She always wants to. I need surprise. She always wants to take everything off the table.
Right.
I mean, the point is that he's got four different voices in his ear. Doesn't know how to sort them through. So someone says, you could use this. Say you want to be surprising. That's what Nixon said in 68. Say, you're not going to telegraph your moves because you don't want to let the enemy know. And then somebody else says, say that she's preemptively removing, arrows from the American quiver on policy. And then somebody else said something else and something else. And then he kind of puts it all together because he doesn't know that these pieces of advice might be contradictory. Just to have something to say. Because what did he say about NATO? Remember that? To be honest, I haven't thought much about NATO. He's the goddamn president of the United States. He hasn't thought much about NATO, the most significant military alliance, practically in world history. So he walked into a buzzsaw there because he's, you haven't thought much about NATO. Well, let me tell you, Hillary said, there's this thing called Article 5. You want to know what Article 5 is? It's the common defense. The only time that it was evoked? After 9/11, by our allies to defend us. Now, if you are an undecided voter and you're actually paying attention and you're listening to what's being said, that was like mic drop. This guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
But that was a lie. He has thought about NATO. He's spent quite a bit of his time on the stump talking about NATO and how it's an obsolete, defunct organization for which we shouldn't respond to our allies in the event that they're attacked by Russia. Very explicitly. Right.
I'm not putting any words in his mouth. We don't get any money from Japan to defend them in nuclear
and
terms.
Germany, right.
Guess how much money we get from Japan? $2 billion a year we get, essentially, as sort of payment for us defending, putting the nuclear shield on them. $2 billion. So he just makes stuff up and he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. And great. You know what we should really do? We should take money from Lithuania in order to, defend Lithuania.
Well, that was the best
Russia.
One. When he contended that Estonia in particular, we shouldn't respond in the event that they invoked Article 5 after they were attacked by Russia, put the lie to his argument that we should be extorting our allies out of a certain amount of money because they don't put enough money to their defense. Well, one of the five nations in that 18-nation alliance structure that does meet the 2% equivalent of GDP threshold that everybody's supposed to meet is Estonia. So he singled out one of the very few nations, he might as well have said the Great Britain, one of the very few nations that actually does meet his criteria and just happens to be one of the nations most threatened by his great friend, Vladimir Putin.
The nation, I think, most threatened.
The nation,
next
perhaps,
to the one that he's already trying to swallow up.
And Poland. So these are the two nations that meet their defense requirements. And he also says that NATO absorbs far too much of our budget. It amounts to less than a tenth of 1% of American defense spending outlays per year to meet NATO's operating budget. He confuses NATO's operating budget with actual defense spending, but that's a digression. Basically, he's saying that I'm not going to defend anybody against Vladimir Putin. And he's been very explicit in his support for Vladimir Putin's geopolitical objectives vis-a-vis Europe and the Middle East. And he did it again last night, where he said, you know, all this stuff that we've been talking about Putin, who knows? Maybe it's a 12-year-old hacker in somebody's basement. Nobody believes
maybe
that.
It's my son, is what he said. It's either a 400-pound guy on his mattress, which I believe actually more precisely describes his base than it would the actual hacking community, or his son Baron, who's really good with computers, which is, you know, again, would be like the Amy Carter moment of this year, except that, you know, he has changed all standards for what ridiculous things someone can say to rule them out of, you know, contention as a serious person.
A digression, but I want to get your take on it. It also gives me an opportunity to plug my own stuff. It was only 24 hours ago that we were in the middle of a absolute media meltdown, complete freakout. We're too close to October for Donald Trump to be doing as well as he is in the polls. So we had the freakout over the fact-checking and whether or not media should be taking a much more aggressive role with Donald Trump because he is an abnormality, an aberration, an antithetical to liberal democracy, and that media needs to get off the referee's chair and really jump at him. And I think Lester Holt did an admirable job of rejecting that pressure. He had a lot of pressure on him to be a fact checker, and he did it twice, in very defensible ways. I don't think he would have felt the need to jump all over Hillary Clinton, you've been fighting ISIS your whole adult life, if he was really in his head about that.
Listen, while the first 15 minutes were going on, I follow a lot of liberals on Twitter, and there were people like the novelist Ayelet Waldman who was saying, Lester, why are you sitting there? What's the matter with you? Meaning, just because Trump was talking. In other words, like, they got to the point that they are so convinced that Trump has no business even being on the stage that the role of the moderator is to say, shut up. Shut up. Let her speak. What's the matter with you? How dare you interrupt her? Or you can't say that, or something like that. And this is not unserious. I mean, this is a gut feeling. Every time it looked like Trump was kind of moving toward taking control of the debate, my Twitter feed was turning purple with rage that he wasn't stepping in and pushing it back in her direction.
And that was poll-fueled anxiety, resulting from a variety of polls, national polls, showing him doing a lot better than everybody thought he would be doing at this stage. And it kind of, and I wrote a post about this, that where was all this frustration 9 months ago? If this guy is such an aberration, if he's such a threat to everything America holds dear, where were you in January when he was at the top of the Republican poll saying exactly the same things he's saying today?
Well, you know, not to make this too personal, but I recall that in February I spent three successive Monday mornings on Morning Joe. And it was me alone with Joe and Mika, and I was saying Trump is a disgrace. Trump, you know, this is a terrible sign for our democracy that he's becoming the nominee. Blah blah blah. And they were like, John, calm down. Are you okay? I mean, you seem to be. I'm worried about you. It's your blood pressure. Ha ha ha.
But everything is going to be all right.
Right. So then, and that was sort of three sessions in a row. And then by June, Scarborough is saying, you know, he's the greatest threat to our democracy ever. And da 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 da. And now, yesterday and then this morning, Mika Brzezinski is sitting there in a condition of pitch terror on that set, worried that Trump has some magical formula that's going to win and Hillary is not going to make it and somebody has to stop it. Now, she was sitting there, they were sitting there on that set thrilled at Trump. He had doubled their ratings, talking about Trump had doubled their ratings, which is good for them and they get bonuses, and you know, this is great.
They like, hosted look at, a town hall in order to counter-program a GOP event that Donald Trump was boycotting because he was having a feud with CNN.
Right, but the whole point here is that they loved it. I mean, Scarborough's got his own, you know, ideological game he's playing, but I mean, liberals loved the Trump rise, even though they were all like, oh, this is terrible. How what does this mean? What does it say? It's so terrible for America, because they liked that the Republican Party that they saw was being destroyed. That's what they liked. And now, suddenly, this is where your point is very potent. So suddenly, when they could have played a role helping some of us in derailing him, they didn't. And now they are in a state of panic. And that's why I wrote a column on Friday in which I said, I can't help it. I love watching this. I love watching them in pain. I love watching the Trump derangement syndrome hit, because they should suffer the way I suffered. Let them have nightmares the way I had nightmares.
And
because we started having nightmares about this in August of 2015, the first really negative piece I wrote about Trump saying this is a terrible sign for our country was July 28th, 2015. And it went from there. And we all sat here and watched Les Moonves of CBS say, boy, Trump's really great for our business. And Jeff Zucker saying, I'm not going to say anything about Trump. It's been fantastic
Where
for
us. Where is all this online anti-Semitism coming from? Did anybody see this?
Right,
in September of 2016,
yeah, I don't know
people
what
are
you're
discovering
talking about. I mean, this is really a dude.
A New York Times reporter was targeted by anti-Semites online.
Well, you know, now I think as of last night and today, from what I can see on social media, liberals are too enthusiastic about their victory dance.
That's exactly right. And this is part of the bubble atmosphere, which is it ain't over. You know, she's only up by two. We all think here that she did well in the debate. Everybody will mostly think that she did well in the debate. She may get a poll bump and all that. But, you know, one bad another story about the emails that reminds people what she did with the emails. Or some, you know, something comes out, the Judicial Watch, you know, had subpoenaed. There's an Ed Klein book coming out next week attacking her. Now Ed Klein is a sleaze, and the book, and he makes, and I don't trust what he says, but who knows what the top line, you know, thing that goes on Drudge is going to be from Ed Klein's anti-Hillary book that may start, you know, making some noise. And our dear friend Daniel Halper, formerly our intern at Commentary, then the web editor of the Weekly Standard, and now the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Post, my paper. There is a documentary coming out called Clinton Inc. about, based on his book, and for all we know, there's some revelation in there. There'll be some kind of little bits and thing. And we know Clinton Cash, the release of Peter Schweizer's Clinton Cash was the beginning, or was one of the two real elements that started tanking Hillary's reputation. So that's all coming in October. Who knows? You know, who knows? This could take many twists and turns. And they're so eager because they don't know anybody who would vote for Trump, because they don't understand the nature of this, and because what they've talked themselves into is only an evil person can support Trump. They're happy to pretend that it's all over again.
And to go back to the 2012 parallel, like conservatives who watched the first Romney debate, they are so relieved to have had this moment, to have said, oh, okay, things are sane now, we're good, we're fine, that was a big scare. But you know, the world has seen reality now.
But remember, the big difference, again, not to now argue against my point, the big difference between now and then is that Romney was down by 5 then, and Hillary's up by 2. So Romney was down, the debate helped him. Hillary's up and the debate helps her. So if Hillary's up even modestly and the debate helps her, that's a way stronger position to be in than being down. So, and by the way, she's still up even in the Electoral College, despite the fact that Trump is moving in on her. She's fading. So that's where we are. And that's where we're going to end. Even, I mean, we went on way too long because it's just so exciting to hear ourselves talk. So I hope you find it exciting to hear us talk. Commentary Magazine, 71-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, stunning insights, one hopes, arguing from the top of the of our intelligence about everything that is going on in the world, both culturally, intellectually, politically, socially, spiritually, with fiction and poetry and book reviews and essays of uncommon insight, we hope. join our conversation. We have daily, wonderful daily blog items from Noah and Jonathan Tobin and others at commentarymagazine.com. You get a couple of free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe. $19.95 for a digital subscription, and $29.95 gets you all access to everything commentary, including our beautiful monthly magazine. Our October issue was just out with a wonderful piece by James Pethakukas called How Bad Is the Great American Slowdown? And other notable items that you can also read online. So please join us, and we will be back with our second podcast of the week on Friday, I think. Friday? Are we going to do it Friday? Thursday? I think we're going to do it Thursday. So that's where we are. And we will see you then. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Get some sleep.